Hello, hockey humans of the world. Welcome to Tough Call Podcast Season 3, where I talk about all the latest hits and suspensions around the NHL. Thanks to you folks, I have over 3,000 Twitter followers and over 250 subscribers to my YouTube channel, which is where you'll find my in-depth video breakdowns of the plays I cover here on the audio podcast. Just go to YouTube and search Tough Call Channel to find me there. And to get the most out of your overall Tough Call experience, the best thing you can do is follow me everywhere you can by subscribing to the YouTube channel Tough Call and leaving comments there, following me on Twitter, at Tough Call Pod, and my other account, at NHL Call. And of course, hitting the subscribe button on this Tough Call audio podcast and giving it a 5-star rating right now. Thanks very much for the support. I don't want to take the hitting out of hockey. I want to put the hockey back in hitting. Hello, folks. Welcome to Tough Call Podcast Season 3, Episode 4, which will cover the period from January 20th to February 4th, 2022. And that'll get us all caught up on things that happened prior to the All-Star break, so we can start the back half of the season fresh coming up here. It's another jam-packed episode because the NHL keeps having questionable hits and controversial calls, which is obviously bad for the safety of the players, but good for content for you and I. So I'll try and take the positive there. Let's keep this thing growing. I've got a lot of growth on my YouTube channel, some new subscribers, so hello to you out there. Thanks for watching, and thanks for paying attention to this. Make sure you encourage others to join the fray, share, follow me at Tough Call Pod on Twitter, and like my Facebook page, find me there. This has been great stuff. There's been lots of good feedback, lots of interaction. You guys are doing a great job sending me clips, so I very much appreciate it. And remember, at Tough Call, I don't want to take the hitting out of hockey. I want to put the hockey back in hitting, that's all. And with that, I'll jump right into this week's WTFs. So here are this episode's WTFs, or weekly total fines and suspensions. And from the NHL's Department of Player Safety, this period they amount to one fine and one suspension. The fine was the Tampa Bay Lightning player Cal Foote for cross-checking. Now, I don't know if you've seen the incident, but what it really was with 18 seconds left in the game, it was a player seeking out an opponent who got him mad at some point earlier in the game, and he cross-checked him and then attacked him with glove-off punches. And before that player even had a chance to recognize what was going on, he kept punching. Now, I don't know enough about the backstory here to really comment on the why or the justification, because I didn't watch the game. But if I'm looking at this incident in isolation, I'm not identifying the cross-check as the main area of concern here like the NHL did. They fined him for cross-checking. I'd have a thing or two to say about not giving a player a chance to square up. I mean, isn't that the code? This is a play that has nothing to do with hockey, which to me makes it a 6-game minimum suspension under my system. You can't just mug a guy at the end of a game as normally accepted behavior. The cross-check wasn't really the problem here. It was just part of an ongoing attack. So the entire attack, to me, is the problem. It wasn't just a fight or a guy instigating a fight with a cross-check. It was a guy mugging another player before the other player even had a chance to understand what was happening and defend himself. That is the big problem. So the fine for cross-checking here, that's a big miss to me. It doesn't identify the proper problem. So that was the fine covered. The suspension was, of course, to Buffalo goaltender Aaron Dell, who took out Ottawa Senators young sensation Drake Batherson from Nova Scotia, my home province. My breakdown video of this incident on my YouTube channel has almost 26,000 views in the first week, and it was very well received, it seemed. Lots of likes and comments. Now, this is one of those cases, to me, where most people who wanted a suspension thought I was a bit soft on Dell, which is rare. Usually I'm noted for having longer suspensions, but a lot of people were kind of upset that I went easy on him. I gave him 4 games, and the real NHL gave him 3 games. So we were pretty much on par, which kind of concerns me. But anyway, some people really wanted him to suffer at 8 to 10 games or even longer. To me, what the issue here is people only wanted to see that because of the severity of the injury to Batherson and that he had to miss the All-Star weekend. But I feel I have to stay true to my system, which is based on how related the action is to a hockey play, how badly I want it out of the game. And here, you know, Dell was at least in a hockey play situation. It was a goalie stepping out to set a pick and protect his defender and, you know, slowing that forechecker down. He just took it a couple of degrees overboard. It was an unfortunate accident, the way Batherson fell into the boards and his ankle twisted up and stuff. It would be really easy to punish Dell longer just because of that, based on resulting injury, but it wouldn't be consistent to me and it wouldn't be right to do so. Now we'll move on to the incident of the week, which for me this time is the Yanni Gord boarding to Juho Vaakkanainen. And there's a video of this on my YouTube channel where it's a little less official this time. I break down the play as I'm watching it. Usually I'm very formal. I do a true suspension video as if I were the NHL's Department of Player Safety. But this time I'm just watching the play and telling you what I see as I see it. And to be fair to Gord, you could pick any number of similar plays in a game and do the same thing. This is not a rare occurrence, and that's the big problem for me. I'm just using this one as an example. The major problem for me, pun intended as you'll see, is that this was called a major penalty, and that after review, for some reason, someone official enough to make these types of decisions saw fit to reduce this to a minor penalty. That to me speaks volumes. It says more than I'll ever be able to explain. How can you watch this on replay and not see the problem? To me, that is exactly what the problem is that you don't see the problem here. Ultimately, it's a forceful hit to a vulnerable player where such force was avoidable and should have been avoided. Instead of going on about it here, I'll direct you to the Tough Call YouTube channel where you should watch my Yanni Gord suspension recommendation video. You can see how I feel about it. You can see the passion I talk about it because I can't believe that this happens so much. And I'll leave you with the question the in-game commentators also asked when they were looking at the replay, and one that I echo. What does a player have to do to get a major penalty for boarding? If this is truly a minor penalty, what does a player have to do to get a major or a match? That is a scary thought to me. So go to the video, leave your answers in the video comments section, and I'll be sure to review them and talk about them next episode. Now, interestingly, we almost kind of did get an answer to the question I just asked you, which is what does a player have to do to get a major penalty or a match penalty for boarding? Because, lo and behold, there was a match penalty for boarding given out in the same period. And I'll be covering it in this week's By Request, which comes from Twitter follower David Kerr, who brought my attention to the Tyler Myers hit on Trevor Lewis. That's the one we'll be talking about. And he tweeted to me simply, "Tyler Myers adding to your caseload right now." And sure enough, I looked to find Myers was given a match penalty for boarding on Lewis. And much like the Gord hit I just talked about, this Myers offering was to a player who anyone could see was going to be in an extremely vulnerable position. Again, Lewis, the opponent, was eligible for controlled contact, but he was not in any form to receive an aggressively forceful onslaught, which is what players seem to want to always dish out, is those menacing, powerful punishing checks when sometimes the situation just doesn't call for it. And I do have a YouTube video of this incident, the Myers hit on Lewis, on my channel as well. And if you want to watch it, you'll see this situation was actually further compounded by the fact Myers was gloved in the face by Lewis just mere seconds before the hit. So there could have been a roughing penalty on Lewis. It wasn't called. So Myers turned around and drove him into the boards. I don't take that into consideration, though, because it's assuming a lot. It's assuming intent. And I try not to guess what a player is thinking at all. I just use the evidence of their actions to show what it looks like they're thinking based on how they present themselves. I can't get into a player's mind and say, you were trying to do this, I'm going to punish you based on that feeling, because I can't prove it. And I'll tell you why it's easy for me to remember not to take that into consideration. It's a little easier for me to take the emotion out of it and judge it objectively on the video because I had a similar incident myself. When I was playing soccer, somebody tackled me, and it was a very hard, aggressive tackle, and they took the ball from me. There was no foul called, and I can't honestly remember if it should have been a foul or not on me, but I know that it was a very aggressive tackle, and it made me frustrated and mad that I had lost the ball in that way. So I got up, and I was fired up. I was very energetic and focused on getting that ball back from that player. And I ran him down harder than I'd ever run anyone down in my life to chase him back to my goal because I had just lost the ball. I had just lost a battle to somebody who overpowered me. And whether it was clean or dirty, didn't matter. I wanted to not have that cost my team. So I ran back as hard as I could, and I was going to do anything I needed to get that ball back. But cleanly. I wasn't that mad, but I looked at, if you had looked at that from an outside point of view, you would have seen a kid get slide tackled, whatever it was, knocked down, lost the ball, and you would have seen them get up and they looked furious and they charged the play, went right at the opponent that just stole the ball from them and knocked them down and aggressively shoulder tackled them. So you might have it in your head that, boy, that was, we better be careful. And you might be almost ready to call a penalty right away to calm things down, because it looked like I was furious. But really, all I was intent on winning that battle back. Nobody wins the battle on me without me putting up a good fight, and I'm going to go win that ball back. I did it cleanly. I was ball focused, and there was no foul on me either. But there could have been, and it might have looked to somebody like I was trying to get revenge for what had just happened to me. But I was not. And so that's why I keep that in mind. Maybe the player is just, you know what, oh, I'm going to win this battle back. I'm not going to lose that again. Can't believe they got the better of me. I'm going to go make sure they don't get the better of me this time. And then you look like you're very aggressive, and you look like you're very full of rage and intent on injuring the player. But really, you're not. You're just trying to win the battle. And I believe that's what Myers was trying to do here. I don't believe that he was trying to run the guy's head in. But even if I did, I have no evidence of that. All I'm going to look at is what he did in the moment in that particular incident. I'm going to forget the glove to the face that just happened before, because I have to take emotion out of the game and try and call it objectively. Now, if I was able to hold actual hearings like the NHL's Department of Player Safety does, I'd ask those questions to these players and maybe get more of the story, but I don't have the benefit of those hearings. So no, I just have to analyze the incident objectively in and of itself. I obviously saw this as a big problem hit, and I'm grateful in this case the match penalty after review was upheld. But what I'd really like to do is hold a hearing for the NHL's decision makers and ask them what they saw differently between this Myers hit and the Gord hit. I can mention one, which is degree of force. The Myers hit to Lewis just seemed more punishing somehow. And one other difference is the Myers hit to Lewis was directly to the head, whereas the Gord hit was to the body, and it resulted in secondary head contact with the glass. But I would argue the problem with each hit is the same. The approach to hitting was the same. It was the same angle of approach and the same cause of the penalty. So if the cause of the penalty is the same, if the reason these hits were bad is the same, then how much should the result really matter? I'm fine if the difference is one being considered a match penalty with a slightly longer suspension and one is considered a major penalty with a shorter suspension. I can see that. I'd be fine with that. But I'm not fine with one being upheld as a match penalty and one being reduced all the way down to a minor penalty, especially when you consider that the rule is that they can reduce to a minor but aren't allowed to rescind the penalty completely, which actually might even mean that after review, they might have seen the Yanni Gord hit as not a penalty at all, but they couldn't take it away completely. They could only give it a minor. And I'd like to ask the official that, too. Did they still see this as a minor penalty, or were they just not going to call a penalty at all, but they had to stick with a minor penalty because that's the rule? I don't see that big a difference between these two hits, to have one be a minor penalty and one be a match penalty, because the cause is the same. And now that I'm thinking about it, it actually leads me back to that Cal Foot fine that we talked about, where he got fined for cross-checking and they completely ignored the fact that he grabbed a person and started pummeling them bare-fisted. They didn't identify the proper cause of the problem or the proper concern of the incident. And I think that's what's going on here. They're just basing it on result, which you can't possibly use as your standard for punishment and then expect to be consistent at all. Hi folks, thanks for listening to Tough Call. If you're enjoying my takes on head contact and player safety, but you'd like to hear me talk about other aspects of hockey, I'd like to take just a minute and tell you about another project of mine, Bolton from Bolton. Bolton from Bolton is where I, Josh Bolton, and my brother Matt, you guessed it, Bolton, set each other up for lively hockey talk covering literally anything to do with it. It's not heavy analysis and stats, it's kitchen banter, like you do with your own family and friends. Head over to YouTube and subscribe to our Bolton from Bolton channel, that's B-O-U-L-T-O-N, or find us on all audio formats as well. We find ourselves funny, maybe you will too, and there's only one way to find out. See you there. And now, back to Tough Call. Now, to tie this all together, we're talking about consistency of punishment, basing the punishment on the result of the incident as opposed to the actual cause of the incident. When talking about suspension length, it's interesting what fans want factored in. Obviously, offender reputation is a big one. Who's doing the crime here? The idea of going very hard on repeat offenders is actually gaining very serious traction, which I like. I'm very big on going hard on repeat offenders. I think the main deterrent to the concept or the theory of that is how unfairly it has been applied in practice thus far. And look no further than Nazem Kadri for what I mean. The word inconsistency doesn't even begin to cover what happens with that guy. The bottom line is, if you're going to go hard on one or two repeat offenders like Kadri or Wilson, you better go hard on all of them, or any meaning in the message of going hard on them will be lost. That brings me to the concept I'm going to focus on here, which is the idea of, say, a situation like Aaron Dell on Drake Batherson, where the victim is injured. The player being suspended should miss as much time as the victim misses due to the injury caused. That's what some fans want to see, whether that be days, weeks, or even months in some cases. I usually see a lot of rebuttals to those comments, which is great, and they seem to be the same rebuttals repeatedly, but I think we really need to spell them out here. Besides the obvious problem that a clean play can also result in serious injury. Now, I know those people, I'm sure, are talking about plays that would already be considered penalties or dirty. They don't really want to see players punished for clean plays. I get that. But I'm just saying, if clean plays can cause injury, then it means that not quite as dirty plays can cause more injury than really dirty plays. So we can't really base our suspension or our punishment on the length of the injury when we already know right off the bat that more dangerous plays can cause less serious injuries. So we're going to be punishing the wrong thing significantly. So there's already a big problem there. But the other aspect of it is teams will use that, I'm sure, to their advantage. You might have a player that doesn't dress a lot who can do something really dirty and injure another team's star, and it doesn't matter if they miss a significant period of time. I know that's the case already, they can already do that, but having the system in place only will make that problem worse, I'm sure. Or if you look at the reverse side of things, maybe a team's star player happens to do something dirty and it injures a player, one of your fourth line players or one of your call-ups. And so you put that player on an injured reserve for a longer period of time because you don't care if they're in your lineup anyway, and it makes the other team's star miss more time. It's just another way to milk the system. Now, I'm not saying teams will do that, but why even put them in a place where they have the opportunity to do it? We're not looking at the right thing here, which is the cause of the injury, the mechanism of the injury, the decision-making of the player that caused the injury. And even going further than that and setting aside the thought of what is a just punishment and what isn't, let's talk about why you even have a disciplinary system to begin with. What is the purpose of punishing a player? Is it just to punish a player after an injury already happened? Or is it to try and prevent injuries from happening in the first place? And that's the way I look at it. You're not suspending just to punish the player who did something. You're not just trying to appease someone who got injured or appease a team that had a violation against them. What you want to do is explain to players what to do moving forward in the future when they end up in that same situation. If you're only punishing players who cause injury, you're basically saying to everyone, that's okay until someone gets hurt and then it's not okay. You're not explaining to them how they could maybe avoid that. You're just saying you're fine until it happens. That to me is a step backward in the disciplinary system. And unfortunately, that's the way things work right now. We're not really trying to address the root cause of the problem. And it's already been pointed out in this episode a few times with real life examples. Identifying the problem with Cal Foot as cross-checking instead of mugging a player. Identifying two hits that are very similar, one as a minor penalty and one as a match penalty. Those are very big problems that have been exposed, and this episode only covers a two-week period. So imagine if you look back 2 months, 6 months, 2 years, what are you going to find in terms of inconsistency and mixed messaging to players where they're not learning the lessons and still repeating the same mistakes over and over again? That is the idea behind your disciplinary system, or at least what it should be. That should be your mandate, is to teach players what to do moving forward so that instead of punishing injuries after the fact, you're actually preventing injuries before they happen. And that is not going to happen if you're basing all of your punishments on the severity of an injury that already took place. And lastly, the fun stuff, the trivia question. Last week's question was, in 05-06, Sidney Crosby and Alexander Ovechkin both had 100 points in the same season as rookies, which was incredible considering only 7 rookies have ever had 100-point seasons at all. And these guys both did it the same year, but they were not the first pair of rookies to score 100 points in the same season. So the question was, who were the first two rookies to score 100 points in the same season? And to answer that, we have to go all the way back to 1992-93. And of course, that's when it would be, because to me, the 92-93 playoffs is possibly the greatest NHL playoff season of all time. So it's not surprising it also would have been a historic regular season in this way. But Teemu Selänne had and still has the highest point total in a rookie season in NHL history. He had 132 points in 92-93 on the strength of his record-breaking 76 goals as a rookie. Now, the other rookie that season to break 100 points was none other than Joe Giugno with the Boston Bruins. And less publicized is, while Selänne set the record for goals in his rookie season, Giugno tied the record for assists in a rookie season. He broke the 100-point plateau with 32 goals to go along with 70 assists as a rookie, tying Peter Stastny, who had 70 assists all the way back in 1980-81. Now, if you can follow me here down this rabbit hole, it might be a little confusing, but I'll piece it together for you. So you had Peter Stastny in 80-81 breaking 100 points as a rookie and setting the record with 70 assists. And also in 80-81, his brother Anton had 85 points as a rookie. And the following year, 81-82, the other brother, Marian Stastny, had 89 points. So that puts all three of the Stastny brothers in the top 20 highest rookie point totals in NHL history. And another fun fact is all three of them debuted as members of the Quebec Nordiques. Then the Quebec franchise moved to Colorado to become the Avalanche, the franchise for which Peter's son, Paul Stastny, broke into the league in 2006-2007. He put up 77 points to crack the top 25 in NHL all-time NHL rookie seasons. So you have brothers Peter, Marian, and Anton, and one of their sons, all in the top 25 in NHL rookie point totals, and all for the same franchise, which is very interesting. And one other thing I'll add to the original question is, a pair of rookies almost scored 100 points in the same season prior to Selänne and Giugno in 1992-93. Honorable mention goes to the late Dale Hawerchuk here. Peter Stastny put up 106 points in 80-81, and the very next season, 81-82, Hawerchuk put up 103 points as a rookie. And as mentioned, also in that 81-82 season, Marian Stastny amassed 89 points, Barry Peterson had 92 points for the Boston Bruins, and underrated Neil Broughton had 98 points, just too shy of coming into the record books with Hawerchuk as the first pair of rookies to post 100 points in the same season. So in actuality, we had to wait till 92-93, even though they were very close in 81-82, we had to wait till 92-93 when Teemu Selänne and Joey Giugno finally did it. So that's the answer to last week's trivia question, and that's the most in-depth answer to a trivia question in Tough Call history. We've already spent a good chunk of time on this segment and haven't even asked this week's question yet. So let's finally get to it. The question is, which NHL franchise is most represented in the top 20 longest suspensions in NHL history? Now, I will add one caveat is that I'm using the parameter of suspensions for on-ice incidents, not off-ice suspensions such as violating the substance abuse protocol or domestic violence, for example. I honestly don't think it changes the answer based on my quick glance, but I just wanted to clarify what franchise has the most players in the top 20 longest on-ice suspensions in NHL history, and I'll have the answer for you next week. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Tough Call Podcast. At Tough Call, I'm not trying to pick on individual teams or players. I want to make the game safer for every player on every team across the league and at every level with no player left behind. I want to cover as many incidents as possible and promote using harsher penalties and player education to meaningfully reduce instances of head contact in hockey. I already get a lot of help from people like you who send me clips or links to incidents or even just a quick tweet or something saying, hey, did you see that? Third period, Bolts-Habs game, checking from behind, something like that. So if you're ever watching a game and you see something questionable or even a good clean check, because I want to promote those as well, send it my way. And don't forget to subscribe to the Tough Call YouTube channel. Find me on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and be sure to subscribe to this podcast right now and give it a 5-star rating. Together, we can put the hockey back in hitting. How you know, man?